So I want to start tonight by just mentioning the obvious, and that is that we just, at the beginning of the sit, we took the refuges, what we call the three refuges, the refuge in the Buddha, refuge in the Dhamma, and refuge in the Sangha. And I find this to be a really helpful practice sometimes. And I also like to stop and think that refuge means a place of protection, shelter, a safe place. And I have gratitude for the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and gratitude for my practice. And I find that the gratitude itself is also a shelter, a refuge, a safe place to go. So, you know, at times when I feel unsafe, or endangered, it's just really nice to go back to the gratitude practice. So I want to talk about gratitude practice and also about related practices that can be enabled or strengthened by gratitude. And the thing about gratitude, of course, is that if I'm not feeling that gratitude, I can still find refuge in the fact that I can remember that I have felt gratitude. I remember what it feels like. I have a memory of gratitude. I know I have the capacity for gratitude. So how much is there about gratitude in the suttas, in the Buddha's discourses, the earliest materials that we have for the Buddha's teachings? Actually, not very much. The concept is there. The word katanyuta is a Pali word that's usually translated as gratefulness. So here's one quote. Reverence, humility, contentment, gratitude, and the timely hearing of the Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha, this is the highest blessing. Samyutta Nikaya. Number 2.4. So that's not big. It's just gratitude as a list of nice things. Here's another one that's more specific. Monks, you should train yourself thus. We will be grateful and thankful, and we will not overlook even the least favor done to us. This is how you should train yourselves. Samyutta Nikaya, again, this is 20.12. This is kind of an interesting little statement because it has, for me, a transactional feel to it. If you're nice to me, I'll thank you. And I find that's a little bit limiting. Of course, there's one more famous sutta that most of you have already heard. This is what I call the famous let your parents crap all over you sutta. It's the one where you're supposed to be so grateful to your parents for raising you that you're supposed to carry them around on your shoulders and let them poop on you, which I find kind of extreme. But, you know, I have to remind myself that I guess they didn't have adult diapers back in the Buddha's day. So the old people had to use their adult children. Anyway, I didn't want to read the whole thing. I just find that kind of a creepy sutta. But there's not a whole lot more about gratitude in the suttas. And I think that's unfortunate. I think it ought to be a parami, one of the 10 perfections, or one of the awakening faculties. Or, I mean, they're all, you know, if I could get into a time machine, I'd go back and I'd give the Buddha a nudge and say, look, I'd like better press for gratitude. It's so important and so helpful. Anyway, I can't do that. Not currently. Anyway. Let me talk a little bit about gratitude. What is gratitude? For many people, gratitude is about gratitude to a particular benefactor, like a deity. I think it's Anne Lamott says that there are two kinds of prayer. Please, please, please. And thank you, thank you, thank you. She also said later on that she thought of a third kind of prayer that she calls, oh, wow, But I think that's just a variety on thankfulness, on thank you, thank you. So, so she's talking about gratitude within the context of prayer. So I know a lot of people who are thankful to a deity for the blessings bestowed upon them by said deity. Fine, if that works for you, then that's great. I have no objection to that. But I do think it's optional. That's my opinion. I think that you can have gratitude and just be thankful for stuff that you've got, for stuff that you enjoy in life, without being thankful to any particular person, or just consider it the luck of the universe. I find gratitude is sometimes it's helpful for me to think of gratitude as being a shift in emphasis, especially when I'm grumpy about something. A shift in emphasis from I have to do this to I get to do this. So for instance, going shopping is kind of annoying. You have to drive somewhere, wear a face mask. It can be crowded. There are lines at the checkout. But then I think about, I was reading in the paper about a man who stood in line for 5 hours in Kabul to pick up one big bag of flour that had to last his family for the month. And so, you know, we're incredibly blessed, if we can use that word, in that we can go to the grocery store and get all this stuff. You know, we get to do this. There's a whole bunch of stuff that you can either see as annoying, or you can just say, wow, I actually get to do this. I get to brush my teeth. A lot of people don't have toothbrushes. So I think of gratitude, and there's so much to be grateful for. The gratitude for loving and having been loved. Gratitude for joy, or if joy isn't available at the time, for the memory of joy, for knowing that we have the capacity for joy, even if the joy is not manifest. We can have gratitude for knowing that the capacity is there. Joy, we've known joy in the past, very good chance we'll know it again in the future. There's a paradox that I want to bring up. A practice, according to many teachers, is about opening up to our immediate experience. This is what mindfulness is all about. This is great. This is a very powerful practice. But getting in touch with gratitude requires some kind of recollection of the past, some remembrance. Now, of course, the Buddha was all about recollection and remembrance. He often encourages recollection of one's good qualities, for instance. So recollection is not a violation of Buddhism. In fact, the root of the word sati is to remember. So going back to gratitude as a shelter, this is remembering that we all have the capacity for joy, even if we're not currently manifesting it. So we don't treat it as a transaction. It's something that we get for free. We don't have to swap it for anything. That is, I'm grateful when things are going well, but not when things are going tough. No, I don't think that's a good attitude to take towards gratitude, because when times are tough is when you need gratitude the most. That's when you need gratitude practice the most. When times are tough, when you need a refuge, when you need a shelter, when you feel endangered, when you are having a tough time, that's when gratitude might seem the most distant. But gratitude is something that you really need. Now, a disclaimer here. It's easy for me to talk about gratitude. Things are pretty good with me, actually. I'm in reasonably good health, so I'm in a good relationship. I'm relatively financially stable. There's a lot of stuff that I can point to or somebody else could point to and say, Bill, you're being kind of hypocritical here, aren't you? It's easy to have gratitude when things are going well. It's much harder to access gratitude when you have, say, chronic pain or if you're going through grief. And I can't really address the problem of chronic pain that effectively because I don't suffer from it. I know many people who do and are still able to experience gratitude for the good things that they have. They're still engaged with their lives. I do want to say something about grief. We have to remember that the loved one who's gone was worth it. We don't grieve a person if that person didn't matter to us. I think a writer, and I'm paraphrasing, it was Anne Lamott again, who said, a friend said to another friend at the death of her husband, grieve, he was worth it. So in part of grieving, we can remember all the things that we enjoyed about that person in the time that we spent with that person. So gratitude is still a possibility even there. I want to talk about gratitude in relationship with metta practice. I've talked about this before, but in a somewhat different context, where I talked a lot about the Brahma Viharas, that is the four heavenly abodes, metta, or loving kindness, karuna, or compassion, mudita, often called empathetic or sympathetic joy, and upekkha, equanimity. These are called the abodes of the gods. It is said that these are the only four states of mind that the Buddha enjoyed after enlightenment. Now, I don't think that's true because you look at the suttas, he certainly was able to experience annoyance, for instance. He once got a little teed off at his monks because they were quarrelsome and he went away for a couple of months. Finally came back after they begged him appropriately. So anyway, how does this relate to metta practice, the loving kindness practice? Well, first of all, I actually like the phrase for metta rather than loving kindness, which to me has a very Victorian sound. I like radiant friendliness. And I like this because for me, that's what it feels like in the body. When the metta is strong, it feels like it's radiating from the body. So I like to, and for me, if I sit down and do metta practice, I can't just follow sort of the classic teaching. The way metta used to be taught where you would visualize a recipient, maybe yourself, maybe a benefactor. Let's say you visualize a benefactor, and then you go through a set of phrases, some of them quite elaborate. We'll end tonight with a set of phrases that Philip Moffat really likes to use. I don't like them because I find them too wordy. But I found and then you visualize the person receiving your good wishes, receiving the phrases are around health, safety, happiness, ease. And you visualize the person experiencing and enjoying these qualities. For me, this practice, and I'd go on retreats, and there would always be one part of the day, 1 hour a day, where there'd be a metta sit, where somebody would guide us through this kind of a guided meditation. And I found it very sterile, very intellectual, and I just couldn't relate to it at all. And then years ago, Philip Moffat said to me, Bill, you should do some metta practice. You should really work on metta practice. And I was going, oh, do I have to? So after whining a little while, I thought about it. And I actually went on a metta retreat. And I've talked about this in another talk. went on a meta retreat where I got to just experiment with what worked and what didn't work. And I connected with a practice that really clicked for me. And I love meta practice now. There's nothing dry or sterile about it at all. It's extremely powerful. And it's something that I feel in the body. So is radiant friendliness always available to me? No, it isn't. I can't just sit down and radiate loving kindness. But what I can do is start with gratitude, because I find I can connect with gratitude very easily, and I can feel gratitude in the body, embodied gratitude. And that for me is a great foundation for metta. And it's the physical experience of metta that gives it its juice, its power. And metta is, for many people, and I know there are teachers who disagree with this. So, but what I've found, and I've heard from other teachers, is that if your loving kindness practice is strong, then the other Brahma Viharas open up in a very natural way, like. Metta is a general bias towards friendliness and well-wishing. Like just that's the fundamental basic setting, your default position. Compassion is what happens when that warmth, when that friendliness meets suffering in the world. That's karuna. Compassion. Empathetic joy, mudita, is what happens when that warmth meets joy in the world. When somebody is experiencing joy, you experience that joy on their behalf. Just gladness that that person is having a good time. And then upekkha is a tricky one. It's usually taught that upekkha is what gives you the balance between it's a way of keeping you. I don't want to go into too much detail because I've gone into this in a lot of detail before. Say, compassion, karuna. It's very easy to get compassion overload, especially if you are in one of the helping professions. If you are a therapist or a nurse or a doctor or a volunteer, you can get really overloaded. And burnout is a very, very common phenomenon with people. So equanimity is what keeps you from losing your balance. Equanimity isn't about calm. It's about equipoise. It's about a balance. So you can be in the middle of activity and still know equanimity. So equanimity is a great way to keep your balance, to keep from losing your balance in the midst of compassion or in joy, you know, veering off into joy that is like a high, overdoing it. But another way I think of looking at upekkha is this is a place where the suffering and the joy, if it's embodied, if it's known in the body, the suffering and the joy find balance. So for me, this is where there's a through line, a line from gratitude that leads all the way through to equanimity. So I think this is, for me, a powerful way of looking at the Brahma Vihara practices and looking at gratitude as sort of the through line that holds them all together, that drives them, that leads to equanimity. And equanimity is, by the way, one of the seven enlightenment factors and is one of the frequently cited aspects of Buddhist enlightenment. So I promised people that it would be a short talk. So we have plenty of time now for questions. Observations, gripes, anyone? You can unmute yourself at any time.
Well, Bill, I want to say thank you it's really feels connecting for me to hear you share with us how you've put these pieces of your practice, of the practices, together, and then delivered it to us in kind of this really neat package. So thank you for that. That was really fun. I could listen to you start at the beginning and say it all over again.
And, well, it'll be recorded. You can do that next week.
And then you asked at the start of your talk, I think you said, what is gratitude? And then you gave some definitions. And forgive my floopy brain, but I have no idea what you said after you asked that question. But I thought to myself, you mentioned some things, and I thought, gratitude, that's not necessarily gratitude for me. Gratitude for me is just a moment of remembering to breathe and to exhale and to listen. It's like, oh, wow, there's a bird outside in the tree singing a song, and I have a moment to stop and listen to it. And I have this new horrible pain in my body. and it's just day and night. It doesn't stop. And I'm able to be grateful. It's only in that one part of that one part of my body, one piece of that part, and that it's not, you know, it's a finger and a knuckle, and it's only in one, and it's not in all five, and it hasn't gotten to the other hand yet. So I'm using a gratitude for that. So just finding moments of contentment or delight or joy, you know, every hour or so in my day, or more if I can. And I love the way you tied it in with the Brahma Viharas. You know, like having sympathetic joy, I learned it as sympathetic joy for another's good fortune, brings me real, you know, softening and opening of the heart. And it's just really lovely. So thank you. Glad I could be here.
Thanks for that. I think that helps broaden the sense of what gratitude means and a relationship with gratitude. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Mary.
So yes, this is this has been a practice of mine for a long time. And I like how you talk about it. So there's a couple of times for me, and it's in the moment, but it's also reflective. It's reflect, for me, it's reflecting in the moment. So my husband and I go for a walk, and the beginning of the walk is always uphill. And I swear, my first part of this walk, it's just like this little grumbly voice. It's just like one of my committee members, like, "Wow, yes, going up the hill. What makes you think this?" And it's just like, it's like, really, this is how you're going to start your walk. And I go, and I just go, look, there's trees, there's birds. I mean, there's a part of me that has to like do like a 180 and flip. And be grateful that I can actually first walk up the hill, right? And that there's trees and there's birds and there's all this other stuff going on. And I mean, in the morning, sometimes I'll just, when I turn the hot water on, it's cold. And then it's hot, I go, I have hot water. Yay, you know? For me, it's just such a counterbalance to that obnoxious little whatever that occasionally wants to crop up and say kind of annoying things, and it's totally unnecessary. It's just it's like don't suck the joy out of my life. Don't suck the joy out of my life. And I think I mentioned before, I read this great article, and if I can find it, I'll post it on it. It was about this person talking about radical gratitude. And Sally and Nikki Ruaga Fury had talked about it, and somebody had their storage shed broken into. And he found gratitude for that. And sometimes I'll be driving, if someone's driving like an idiot, I just think, I am so glad I'm not in their hurry. It's really amazing how just taking that and not taking things personally and just taking that little flip of gratitude, and then it becomes, for me, it becomes more of a default that I can nip that other bit of the rant-a-rant, what I call, voice, and just go, no, yeah, like in the store, whatever it is. So I think it's, for me, it's just an important reminder of my day as I live my life and I want to have the Dharma, like, am I available to the Dharma? If I'm feeling gratitude, I'm much more available to the Dharma than if I'm griping. So, yeah.
That's great. Thanks for that. I just jotted down radical gratitude on a post-it, and I will look that up. I'm curious about that.
It's really a good article.
But it's great. It sounds a lot like you've done that same kind of transformation from I have to do this to I get to do this, and a couple of other things too. So that's great. Thank you so much.
May I say something?
Sure, Mary.
Okay, I don't have to put up my hand or anything. I'm not very good at this kind of stuff.
That's fine.
I was going to say that I recently was carjacked.
Oh.
And yeah, so that was pretty overwhelming. And I'm not always so great at finding gratitude in every situation. But actually, I was happy because eventually I came around to the fact that I got out of the situation. I knew what to do, and I wasn't hurt in any way. And actually, in the end, it was only material things that were stolen. I mean, it was a lot of material things, but I got through it. And somehow it just being grateful, it kind of felt like it was a step up, but it was some kind of a little bit of a transformative moment for me because it was such a huge challenge. And it took me a while to get to this, but ultimately I got to the fact, well, I'm grateful. I'm just so grateful I wasn't hurt and I knew what to do and I got through it. It's probably never going to happen again. And I tell people the story and they are inspired, you know, in some ways by it. And so,
I admire your practice. That's
I wouldn't want to do it again, but
of course not.
Since I had to go through it.
It's a once in a lifetime experience, one would hope.
Yeah.
Not twice, but still, that's great. And I hadn't even thought of that sort of gratitude for the fact that things could have been so much worse.
Could have been worse. Yeah, absolutely could have been worse. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that. That's a really different approach, one that I hadn't thought of, but yeah, that would be helpful in a lot of situations, particularly for people with injury or chronic pain.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Anyone else? Oh, Corey.
Hey, Bill. Thank you for that. That was really lovely. Except for the poo part. I'm going to have to look that one up. But grateful that I don't carry my parents on my back, I guess. I wonder what you think about generosity and how the Buddha supposedly made that the first practice for I don't know if it was for new monks or what. I've always heard this, and now it's been so long that I'll fill it in with my memory details that weren't actually there. But apparently he trained people to start with generosity, and it seems like if they're not two sides of the same coin, at least generosity does engender gratitude or thankfulness on the recipient, right? So I wonder if you have any thoughts about that with the lack of discussion of gratitude in the suttas. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yes, I do. And I think you've already done a pretty good job of covering it right there. What Corey's talking about is that it's become more recently emphasized that the Buddha, when he first started teaching people or a group of people, a new group of monks, he would start with, lay people, he would start with generosity, and then he would go to ethics before he would even go to the Four Noble Truths. So, and I think you're right that generosity and gratitude go hand in hand. It's easy to be generous if you're feeling grateful. It's easy to feel grateful if you're generous too. And we usually think of them as separate entities. And yes, I think you could think of them as different ways of describing the same or at least closely, all of these words have the quality of being a little bit slippery, as language tends to be. Like, I think generosity covers more ground than just one phenomena, and the same thing with gratitude. But certainly there's a huge overlap in the Venn diagram. Certainly a big part of it where you can look at it as two sides of the same coin. I like to say all the people I know who are really happy are generous, and all the people I know who are generous are really happy. And I have a feeling that both categories of people also have a real sense of gratitude. Because gratitude, when you're grateful, you feel like, I think there is a sharing aspect of it. And having gratitude fuel the meta practice is part of that, because when the gratitude is strong, radiating friendliness as a warmth, as a physical sensation, as you know, that sense of tingling, of light, of brightness, it's just natural to radiate it out. So I think the natural relation to that would be, it's much easier to give of anything, to be generous, whether it be money or time or listening or whatever it is that expresses generosity in the particular moment when generosity might be called for. If you have gratitude, you're much more likely to take advantage of that opportunity for generosity. So thanks for bringing that up. I wish I thought of it when I wrote the talk.
Inspired.
Barbara.
Yeah, the whole thing about generosity and gratitude. When you think that the Buddha started out everything with gratitude, you know, generosity. And in a way, generosity is one of those ways of dissolving the boundaries of the self, because you're giving what you cling to and what you identify with. This is my time. No, I'll give it to you. So there's this generosity is this dissolving the self. And I think gratitude is too, because when you're grateful to not even necessarily a person, but grateful to life or the universe, and suddenly it's not, I did this, I'm responsible, this is my joys. No, it's I'm grateful. And so that sets you in relationship and in context. And then there's less of this solid self that is the cause of all suffering.
Thank you. That's really good. You guys are coming up with some great stuff here. It's really nice to just be able to sit here and let you guys do the teaching. This is good stuff. Thank you so much. Anybody?
Sorry, Kylie calling in here.
Hi, Kylie.
I just really resonated. That was a lovely talk, and thank you so much.
For
practice. And just hearing Barbara now speak, I totally resonate with the liberating quality of gratitude and loving kindness for me personally. And I really smiled to myself when I heard you say that when you first came upon metta practice, that you found the phrases a bit sterile, and as did I. And it wasn't until I connected with the felt sense in the body, which took a lot of practice, that it began to resonate. And then I became overwhelmed by it, especially when calling to mind loved ones and practicing metta for them. And that's where equanimity came into it for me. And then I heard a teacher say that that karuna and metta without equanimity could easily dissolve into pity. And that really made sense for me, because every time I would bring one of my children or a loved one to mine, I would end up in tears and overwhelm. So it has been a very vital practice for me, metta practice, and I try and do it every day, but gratitude also. And I have a gratitude buddy, and it's really simple, but it's really powerful. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for that. That's great. I didn't spend time touching on it, but there's this idea that all of the Brahmaviharas, like compassion and sympathetic joy, have a near enemy and a far enemy. And the near enemy is that which disguises itself as the Brahmavihara, and pity is something that is close to compassion, and yet it's not true compassion, because pity tends to be sort of like, oh, I'm glad I'm not like that. There's a lot of selfing in pity. Compassion is really open-hearted. Now, none of us are enlightened, so our compassion will never be pure, complete, open compassion. There will tend to be other little bits of it, like, I'm glad that's not me, or, you know, oh, that's pitiful. There's always a little bit of that, and it can be helpful to be aware of that. But equanimity is a really powerful way of avoiding veering into the near enemies, because the near enemies can be a great trap, and they can be a great practice, because you can watch yourself selfing in the process. Thank you for that. We have time maybe for one more, and then we can do our metta.
I've already spoken, so if somebody else wants to speak.
I just wanted to emphasize the I get to versus I have to. That when I take that into a project, even something as simple as doing the dishes, that I get to do them instead of I have to. It changes everything for me.
Absolutely. So thank you
for reminding me.
And I end up with clean dishes, too. It's a bonus.
Yeah, and warm hands.
So, Deborah?
I was just... This is so interesting that you're talking about this, because I was just listening to Tara Brach just before our sangha, and she was also talking about, giving loving kindness to ourselves. And, you know, that's always very hard. But I just read a story somewhere, and I don't remember if that... I was reading the old book that many of you may know, Random Acts of Kindness. I think that's where I saw it a couple of nights ago. I was just took it off my shelf and was rereading it. And there's a story about some woman who, you know, was kind of affluent, and there was like a crisis in her town or in her community. And somebody started leaving food baskets on her doorstep. And she was really irritated that somebody would think that she, you know, needed a food basket. And every day this somebody left a food basket, and she had all these food baskets in her kitchen when she suddenly realized that she should be giving away these food baskets to other people who were in need. So this was really like a benefactor teaching her a lesson, I think. But these food baskets kept coming, and after a while, they stopped. And so then this woman, who obviously had some selfing going on, right, she took it upon herself to start making food baskets and delivering them to the people in her area who had been affected by whatever, I can't remember, a flood or an earthquake or something. So your talk tonight and everybody's sharing has reminded me of that story, and it's prompted me. I'm going to start leaving notes under this person's door who lives in my building. She's so miserable. I feel so hurt by her. She's just so rude. And I don't even think she knows my name. And I just am going to start wishing her loving kindness and leaving her kindness notes under her door. I hope that won't be too intrusive. And just maybe that will be my food basket. I don't know. If anybody thinks I shouldn't do that, text me later.
let me suggest something to you. Because the thing about leaving a note is it's when you leave a note, it's because you want an outcome. You want to have an effect. Here's a great practice.
No, actually, I don't expect any change. I really, really don't. I don't. But I appreciate what you're saying.
Right.
It's probably true a lot of the time.
It's something, right. Look at that wish in yourself.
Yes.
You know what's a really powerful practice is wish her metta without letting her know that you're wishing her metta. And watch her change. Barbara has this great story about wishing metta to a next door neighbor who was very, very difficult. And over time, this it eased. I won't go into details, but wishing metta, it's a little bit like Christian prayer. It changes things. It changes you. It changes the universe around you in ways that you can't quantify. And I don't want to get real umi-gumi about this, but seriously, try the metta practice without any wish for a result. It's the result is where you start getting into
science. Right, right. I don't think I'm powerful enough to get a result. You know, I don't think I'm going to change anybody's. I would like to be less reactive to this woman because it makes me, I mean, I'm not the only person who feels this way, and I don't want to get into anything that even smacks of gossipy, but it's like, I don't understand it. And I just figure she must be really unhappy in some way. And I would like to just give her a treat somehow, you know, just give her some love or give her a smile or give her a hug. I miss something, a face mask, something, a colorful face mask, something to make this woman happier. But anyway, thank you, Bill.
Well, thank you for that. And I think it's, let's just take a moment of silence and reflection. And gratitude.